Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. April 14, 2020. We will not be the same again. In this difficult time of the coronavirus pandemic, women can perform much greater work than men because they have more connection with life, stronger sense of life in relation to their family and children. After this epidemic, people will not be the same. It will take several months and everyone will get used to this new state. We will begin to perceive the world in a new way, we will feel that it is under the control of the upper force. Everyone now has the same questions: where did this problem come from? Why? What will happen next? Suddenly we lost our strength to pursue the different pleasures of this world. The main thing is to survive and for us and our children to live peacefully in this world. This is a very important stage in the education of humanity. The virus will educate us so that we will not be the same people again. Imagine that in 4, 5, or 6 months we will see the epidemic subside and the coronavirus stop circulating between us, then we will already be different. In the meantime, we just need to support each other and keep explaining that this blow came from nature because we breach its laws and violate its integrality and globality. We destroy nature and, as a result, involuntarily we pull all these viruses out of it and force them to manifest. If we continue to treat nature this way, there will be many more new viruses, much more terrible than the coronavirus. Therefore, there is no choice. We must change the relationships between us and our attitude to nature, and then everything will fall into place. First of all, we must understand that the coronavirus is a consequence of the imbalance in nature made by humans. This imbalance stems from the lack of friendly connections between people. We must exist in an integral system, but instead we do the opposite and are moving further and further away from each other. Egoism is growing all the time and increasingly placing us against each other. If we do not stop the process of global separation, we will cause even more harmful viruses to appear. Everyone agrees that there is a need for connection between people, but they do not believe that it is possible to achieve and consider it a beautiful dream. However, the fact is that we are not required to achieve connection, we just have to want to come to it. By yearning for connection, we are already investing our effort in nature, and as a result nature gets corrected and improves. Then all sorts of pests, including viruses, will stop crawling out of it. From the Kabbalah Lesson for Women, April 4, 2020. Exodus from Egypt by the entire world. If the friends externally fulfill the requirements of students, participate in lessons and in the meetings of friends, then I don't have the right to leave them. The Creator brought me to them, and I must work with them. Especially now, in our time, to be in a Kabbalistic group is a happy opportunity received from above. The Creator pulls us toward Him. If a person at least somehow relates to this process, more or less, then I don't conduct any criticism. For me the main thing is to be connected with everyone in whom there is such a desire. Believe me, we are in a special state called the Exodus from Egypt. This is the outcome of not just one small group led by Abraham, but of representatives of all humankind, all people, all walks of life. We all want to exit our egoism, to rise and unite with the Creator. The Creator helps us in this. It is not by accident that the coronavirus epidemic has come, which facilitates the exodus from egoism. The Creator wants to show us how wrong our connection is, and therefore He puts us apart from each other through the coronavirus. Now we need to understand how to connect again, but in the right form. As soon as we are ready to connect correctly, the virus will disappear. We will not return to the old world, but will come to a new connection, to a new society, to new occupations. Life will not be the same as it was before the coronavirus. Therefore, it is necessary to explain to all of humanity what the Creator requires of us. It is friendship toward each other, It is love in order to reveal the properties of bestowal, it is unity between us, and from love for the creatures to come to love for the Creator. From the second part of the Daily Kabbalah lesson March 31, 2020, the writings of Rabash, the need for love of friends. Answers to your questions, part 238. Question: what is the state of the Creator since he is in bestowal, bestowal for the sake of what? Answer: to raise you to himself. Question: with regard to the study of Kabbalistic sources, which takes place face to face, a teacher or one of the students addresses the group and passes on their knowledge and experience to everyone at once. Should it not be supplemented with dialogues between each and everyone? Answer: I follow the example of my teacher Rabash. Why don't we like to study? Question: in this world, everyone likes to teach, but no one likes to study. What is the spiritual root of this phenomenon? Answer: it is the ego that likes to preach because it controls others this way. We need to try and get rid of it. Question: so, do I annul myself a little when I study? Answer: when you study, you must annul yourself, subdue yourself, in order to learn something. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, January 12, 2020. The Tower of Babel is the essence of relationships between people. Remark: the book of Genesis describes how people built the Tower of Babel. They built it high. Those who raised bricks rose from the east side of the tower, and those who went down came down from the west side of the tower. And if someone fell and died, they did not pay attention to him. But if a brick fell, they sat and cried, "When will another rise instead?" My response: here allegorically it speaks about the Babylonians' egoism having increased to such an extent that they did not respect human lives, but only valued a person's work. If a person could not bring benefit and his productivity fell, it was better that he simply die, disappear. Such people were not needed. That is, they were purely pragmatic toward each other. From Cab TV's Systematic Analysis of Israeli People Development, June 24, 2019. New Life 1184, The Formation of Life.
Hello, and thanks for being with us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Nitza Mazoz. Hello. And today we'd like to talk about the creation of life. We'll try to understand, maybe, how did the inanimate become animate? Be with us. It's going to be really interesting. Nitza, please. Now, the creation of life or its origin is one of the most intriguing things studied by science because, of course, this has implications. We study the processes we went through in order to learn how to further advance. And we study things in retrospect in order to better understand our future. So scientists can more or less say at what point in life did the still turn into vegetative and the vegetative turned into animate. But what's unclear is what is that moment where the inanimate became animate. But first of all, let's try and understand what is the inanimate before we understand what life is. The inanimate is a desire that wants to absorb that which is to its benefit and to reject whatever is to its detriment. The way it's arranged, the way it was formed, the desire to absorb what's to its benefit and to push away what's to its detriment. Yeah. In its simple form, it's called the inanimate. And the wisdom of Kabbalah calls it a desire.
Yeah.
It's interesting because usually desire is something that we attribute to a higher degree, like to humans. No, take any still matter. Doesn't it have a desire? It keeps its structure, its form. It rejects other things. You can't break into its boundaries. Even if its air is something, you have to permeate it. All the more if it's liquid or solid matter. And therefore it's a desire, meaning that it stands its ground. Meaning that it keeps a certain order inside of it, a certain inner structure.
Yeah.
If so, then this is the still. And if so, what is the animate then? What is life? Life means that it receives and gives. That there's already an action in it. Not only an action. There is an entire system that knows what does it have to absorb and what does it have to emit. But also the still, you said that it knows what to absorb and what to emit. Yes, but here we have a specific kind of absorption. I'd say a scrutinized one, a selective one. What does it absorb from its environment and what does it give to its environment? Inside there is metabolism. And if so, it has a mutual connection with the environment. And there are different forces and substances that are emitted from it. And instead of it, it receives substances and forces from the environment. This is already the feeling of life. I read this definition of what does NASA say about life. It says that it's a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. This is how it defines it. So, life, according to what you're saying, is anything that's animate and has some kind of interaction with its environment. Yeah. That it plans and controls. The still has no interaction with the environment. It does, but it has no systems by which it can change itself. This is why it's called still. Can you explain? Because it has unchanging qualities. Its attitude toward the environment doesn't change. But it is the way that it is until the external forces will turn it into something else. What additional factor is added to the still that suddenly turns it into an animate system? The desire to absorb good things and emit bad things. Meaning, additional desire, not only, it's an entire inner system where it knows what is to its benefit, what is to its detriment, and correspondingly the systems that perform the absorption and emission are revealed in it. In every transition from the still to the vegetative, there is an entire system that starts developing. And then there's another leap from the vegetative to the animate, meaning it gets an additional, more sophisticated system, or what? More sophisticated, with the ability to scrutinize, with the ability to absorb and emit, bring closer what's beneficial, pushing away what's harmful, not like the still or even like the vegetative, which is nonetheless very limited in its actions, meaning according to the measure to which its desire to keep itself is small, it doesn't move that much really, only in relation to the sun, the air. But the animate has a very strong desire, and it wants to absorb more and emit more. It has very big systems for digestion and for everything, for breathing, for everything. And therefore, it can move from place to place. It has to look for a better place. It procreates differently than the vegetative. It's a really new world, the animal world, the world of animate bodies. And this is how it exists. Now, there's this concept called spontaneous evolution that talks about the transition from the still to the vegetative, where they can't explain, then this is how they call it. Right. So, according to the wisdom of Kabbalah, what causes the still to suddenly develop a more sophisticated system that knows how to select and interact? I'd say that nothing happens spontaneously, this one thing. Another thing is that even before we start talking about the real still, very primary still, there's already a system that exists in potential that is later on realized, actualized in substances, that this system develops and is built and is arranged to bring forth all of these substances in the still vegetative, animate, and in humans, that it develops them, reveals them, builds them. And that we see before us, the still, the vegetative, the animate, and the speaking, it's all in all a result of that which already exists in nature and potential, and now is executed in practice. So there is a kind of template that develops us all the time, taking us through different evolutional processes. So, why did life begin then? Why was it suddenly created? What for? Life was created so that the force of absorption, the desire to live, to receive, to enjoy, to absorb, that exists in the still, the vegetative, or animate bodies, for this force to be able to fully develop. Do you think that man will ever be able to turn the inanimate into animate? Never. Why? It's impossible. Because he doesn't have the ability to change the inner desire of nature. So, man can take some living tissue and make something of it, of course. But to turn the inanimate into animate, if it's really something inanimate, never. There are many experiments in the field, so I'm asking. Now, about the degrees of connection between the still, the vegetative, and the animate. Is there some kind of connection between them, communication? Yeah, the connection is that there has to be an inner system that keeps itself, a protective system, first and foremost, that protects this created being, this creature, all of them, making sure that it doesn't move, it doesn't change, that nothing happens to it, that it simply protects what it is, meaning the next moment has to be like the previous one. And to the measure to which it has reached that, and that it already has these steady, fixed, protective systems that keep it in a constant state, then the system itself develops, leading it to more complex states. And then it accordingly evolves, absorbing more and more information and substances, and also correspondingly emits more information and substances, and then this force is called the vital force. We see something very interesting, that a certain degree has developed something more advanced, but it doesn't disappear. It's not that all the still turned into vegetative. Do these levels have a certain role? Nothing disappears. Everything exists in nature. We see that there are certain forms that disappear. But the foundations, like on the still level, they remain. They're kept as a part of the developmental process. Of course, they change too. It's not the same rocks or water or air, but still. I want to ask about something you previously explained. You said that what we see in nature, the still, the vegetative, the animate, that it's only a result of that which exists in nature in potential and is later on realized in practice. So, just to see if I understand, before evolution advances to the still, vegetative, animate, with all the varieties and species and everything, you're saying that all the forms that we'll see on Earth exist in nature in potential to begin with?
Yeah.
And afterwards, they're realized in practice. So where do they exist in nature and potential? In potential, as a force. You don't see forces. Is it a still force, vegetative force? What is this force? A force is a force, meaning that it's not clothed in anything. And what's defined in it? Everything. The entire evolution of the still, vegetative, animate, human beings, and everything that occurs with them throughout their thousands of years of evolution already exists in that force that exists in nature. Where? There is no place, because it's a force. Now, when we look at how life evolves, we see that these are systems that are becoming more and more sophisticated, complex. What is evolution preparing for us from this point on? Are there any further forms of life that are awaiting us? No. Are human beings the peak of evolution? Yeah, if you can call it a peak. I don't see it that way, but suppose. So this is what I'm asking about. Meaning, obviously, it's not the peak yet. There is yet what to get to. We have to acknowledge that we are the most miserable, ignoble, low, evil, bad, and that we have to correct ourselves. Because we're the only ones in nature that are harming all of nature. Really doing harm to the still, the vegetative, the animate, to people on the human level. We're destroying everything. Therefore, I wouldn't say that we're the peak of evolution. I'd say that we're the abyss of evolution, and we have to acknowledge that and to start correcting ourselves. Previously, you said that all the forms of development that will occur in evolution, they're all predetermined in that force that exists in nature. Yeah. So the current state where mankind is destroying all the rest of the species on this planet is also predetermined. Of course, Kabbalists wrote about this thousands of years ago. So, if you're saying that all the forms and species and degrees that we saw in the development of the still, the vegetative, the animate, and our development as a human species and so on, and up to the point where we're destroying everything around us, all of this is determined in potential in that force of nature, then what are the future forms that are supposed to be revealed if everything's predetermined? No, we have to reach the recognition of evil that nature, to begin with, planned us, as opposed to all the rest of its parts, in a way that we are out to destroy each other. No other creature of the still, the vegetative, the animate degrees, no other creature besides the human degree develops to a state where it destroys itself and others and its environment and everything. It's good that we can't fly to some other place in outer space because we destroy it too. So, that which exists in human beings that does not exist in the still, the vegetative, and the animate is like this destructive desire. Yeah. That's the special thing that we got. Yeah, our desire to receive. So there's this destructive desire that also has a role, as I understand. It does. What is it? We have to investigate it and understand that it's pushing us to destroy our entire little planet, and that will decide that we have to build a different life based on love and connection and on bestowing good to everyone. This is what we have to do. And we'll have to change our attitude toward the rest of nature. This is precisely what is upon us human beings to do. And then we'll see a different life. Life, our way of life, will change once we change our attitude. Not instantaneously, but it's a process. How will life change? When I asked you what life is, you said that it's a system, a complex system that knows how to absorb what's good for it, how to emit or push away what's bad for it, and you said that this is life. A more advanced form of life, what is that? Where we act to the benefit of society and not to the benefit of our particular ego. Meaning that we don't go on a path of collision with one another like some particles or vicious beasts or something, but that we're above our egoistic nature and we treat each other in a friendly way. So there's a very meaningful point in evolution here, that the mechanism that up until now, starting with the still and up to the point where we are today, that was used to absorbing what's good and emitting what's bad in this ever-developing, increasingly sophisticated system, that it has to understand something, that it can no longer develop in this direction. What I'm looking for is that transitional point or phase where the still suddenly became vegetative. What will make us change our ways? Yeah, how is our inner system supposed to understand that it's supposed to evolve differently? Suffering. The feeling of death approaching. It will cause us to understand that something in this process has to change. Yeah. Otherwise, we'll die. We'll reach a point where we destroy ourselves completely. Did evolution come to an end? Evolution in the way that it's bringing us to the biggest possible egoistic desire came to its end. What does it mean that evolution came to an end? What, nature is going to sleep? No. It brought us to a state where we're developing in the last stage of the ego, and in this stage, the ego has to acknowledge that it's destroying, that it's consuming itself. And what will be the next degree of evolution? That instead of destroying ourselves, we'll take the forces that exist in nature, and that we'll correct ourselves using our ego in a correct way. So there are additional forces in nature that the system that's sustaining us right now, our system, hasn't identified yet, right? Some kind of external force that it didn't identify yet, with the help of which it can advance to a more developed way of life. Yeah? In the development from the still to the vegetative, there was some kind of critical development. Yeah. The state that we live in today as a mankind in the system of nature, is there another essential change awaiting us? The recognition of evil? That our nature is evil and that it's pulling us toward destruction. And then the next essential change, what will it be? That we will resist this and we will build such systems that will educate us, that will teach us how to move away from this evil, from using our ego unboundedly. And this more advanced being, creature that will go through this essential change, how will he be different, smarter, more emotional? What will change about such a person? Just the recognition of evil. that he will feel that it's possible to use the ego in a bad way and in a good way, and he'll want to use it for the better. What will he know to do that a person doesn't know how to do today? How to do good to others. So, it's not that his form will change like the still turned into. No. So, our change, the essential change for us, won't be something physical. We'll probably still have 2 feet and so on, but something internal will change in us that will evolve. Yeah. Why so? In all of our previous developments, we did see a change in form. Still, vegetative, animate, man. Why not the next change? Because we've reached the final and worst form, which is very evolved, and so much so evolved that it can destroy everything. Thank God we only got this planet in order to try and destroy it and to learn from it as much as we can. And here to perform self-scrutiny and to, so to speak, repent. What is this more advanced way of existence? How would you define it? You can do it right now. Start loving everyone and treating everyone according to the law of love. Everything, still, the vegetative, the animate, people, everything. How will that influence my life? You'll get great satisfaction through these creatures, the still, the vegetative, animate, and the speaking, by treating them with love. Through them, you'll start feeling reality, that they're all included in you and that you are included in all of them. And then what follows is that you're integrated with the entire world and you reveal the force that works, acts in the entire world. It's called the acting force and the enacted being. You start acknowledging the force of nature that develops nature, evolves it, enlivens it. And this is how all the created beings exist. So you start identifying with that force that controls nature called the Creator. This is the force that, to begin with, you said that all the future forms of development are defined in it. Yeah. And why is it that by an attitude of love toward the still, the vegetative, the animate, toward all the people around me and everything, I can reveal this force in nature? Because it exists in everyone and everything, only you don't exist in the same values in order to reveal it, to feel it. So it's hidden. You're the one that's hiding, concealing it. Because of your disparity in qualities, you're in hate towards everyone, and he is in love towards everyone. So, what is the peak of life? The peak of life is in love toward everyone to feel the whole, complete, perfect, and eternal reality. And you yourself to become whole, complete, and eternal. I have a question. Everything that you've explained here and now is what the wisdom of Kabbalah teaches, right? Where would you categorize the wisdom of Kabbalah compared with the religious attitude toward the development of life and the scientific attitude or approach towards the development of life? It's completely unrelated to the religious approach. And it's somewhat related to the scientific approach. But it depends on how you use science in order to explain the wisdom of Kabbalah. And if going back to the wisdom of Kabbalah itself, how does it define the creation of life and its development? The force of bestowal that exists in the substance of the will to receive is called the light of life, the spirit of life, that exists in a dead body. And life itself, how would you define it? Life itself is the measure of suitability between the creature called man and the general force of bestowal called the creator. In Hebrew, bole, from the words bo ue, come and see. This is called life. Last question. Mankind, the mankind of tomorrow, how will it be essentially different than mankind as we know it today? In that everyone will understand what is good and what is bad, and will move away from the bad to the good. Dr. Leitman, what can I say? I have a million more questions, but our time's unfortunately up. Thank you very much. Thank you, Nitza. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.
New Life 1207, The Evolution of Antisemitism.
Hello, and thanks for being with us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Leitman. Hello, Dr. Leitman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Yael Shadarel. Hello. And today we'd like to talk about the evolution of anti-Semitism. Maybe we'd like to talk about other, better things, but still, there is anti-Semitism in the world, and it's evolving, and we'd like to understand, where is it headed? Be with us, Yael, please. Yeah, we see that there was anti-Semitism all throughout history, only it came in different packages. In ancient times, the evolution of anti-Semitism started with religious anti-Semitism. Mostly people were idolaters, and suddenly there was this kind of religion that believes in one God, and it was perceived as a kind of disregard for all of their gods and so on. Later came Christianity, and the Jews were blamed for killing Jesus. In the Middle Ages, there were many blood labels. Jews were looked upon as the manifestation of Satan, and only if they convert to Christianity can something good come out of them. Meaning, up to this point, we're talking about religious anti-Semitism. Later, it was a more social kind of anti-Semitism, that Jews harm society, that they take their money. They have the most powerful positions in the country. They're actually the ones that control everything and influence society as a whole to its detriment. Later, there was a more racial kind of anti-Semitism, like we saw in the Second World War, where the last stage of anti-Semitism is political anti-Semitism, that there is strong resistance and acute criticism against Israeli policies. This is the modern kind of anti-Semitism. And nowadays we see all the different kinds of anti-Semitism together. Religious anti-Semitism, especially from the side of Islam. There's the racial kind of anti-Semitism that because you're a Jew, then it's allowed to hurt you in different ways. And of course, there's the economical background that Jews are greedy, that they use the world, sucking their money and everything. And also there's, of course, the political anti-Semitism against Israeli policies. So this is a short overview of the different kinds of anti-Semitism. And we'd like to ask, is anti-Semitism going through some kind of evolution? First of all, you gave a very good overview of the development of anti-Semitism in parallel to the development of mankind. And there's not that much to add. Of course, we can elaborate on each of these stages, but in general, this is correct. The only thing I'd like to add is that anti-Semitism, it develops, it evolves, and why shouldn't it? Because it lives within the very foundations of human society. Because the egoistic desire that exists in man, the more it evolves, the more it feels that in front of it there is something that is its very opposite, which is that point that's called Israel or a Jew, that says that it's necessary to develop, to evolve above the ego, that instead of dispersing and moving away from each other, that we have to reach love another as yourself. And that point is the very opposite of our nature, and it exists in several people that are called Jews. Why are there such people that have this point and people that don't have it? It's very interesting that this point called a Jew or Israel, consisting of the words Yashar Kel, meaning to be aimed straight at the positive upper force of nature, as opposed to the rest of mankind that comes from the negative force of nature. These are two forms in nature, the two forms of nature. And therefore, what follows is that there are people in whom exists the negative egoistic force, and there are people that have both the negative egoistic force and the positive altruistic force. And when both of these forces exist in them, the positive and the negative, they're called Jews, according to their inner essence. And those in whom the positive point of bestowal, connection, and love of others has not yet been revealed, they're called the nations of the world. We went through many stages of development throughout history, and that point that was revealed in ancient Babylon and some of the Babylonians called the point in the heart, the point of bestowal, of love of others, of connection, this point developed in Babylon. And those people that joined Abraham, as we see from the sources, Abraham arranged them as a group, and he called this group Israel, consisting of the words Yashar Kel, meaning those that are aimed straight at attaining the upper force of nature, which is the force of bestowal, as opposed to the force that exists in human beings, which is the force of reception, which is the opposite force. And this is how they develop these two groups. There were those who left the group of Israel and were inclined toward what we call the nations of the world, and there were those from the nations of the world that felt that they have this special closeness, something that draws them to Israel, and this is what they did. Meaning, Jews are not a nationality, but it is according to the point in the heart in which a person feels associated with the positive force of nature and not the negative force that all of mankind is in, that comes from the ego. And this is how we see human development. The more humanity evolves and develops, the stronger its demand towards Jews, towards those that say that we have to be connected between ourselves and with the upper force. And then, all of mankind that does not feel this inclination, but that feels that there is some kind of rift, some kind of a division, a greater and greater distance between them and the Jews. And therefore, here there is plenty of room for different speculations, philosophies, thoughts. And besides, you also have the matter of the different methods, religions, beliefs. Because Jews say that it's necessary to be connected with one another, and that the only thing to bow to is this force of connection, to see it as the goal, the force of correction, a special force that is higher than man, and that besides that there is nothing, neither in corporeality nor in spirituality, but only the force of bestowal. And the force of reception was given to us only in order for us to be able to distinguish the force of bestowal, to exalt it. And those that belong to the force of reception, they say, no, we have many gods, we have many methods. Everyone can pray to their own god and to worship him however they want. And it's all pluralism, and we understand each other. Besides the Jews, we understand everyone. And if so, it really divides mankind into two camps, where there is the one camp that's really small, called the people of Israel, from the words Yashar Kel, being aimed straight at the force of bestowal, and the other camp, the nations of the world, that have different images, idols, and so on. And Israel don't have something like that, because eventually what they need is to only be connected between them. Meaning, they don't have to perform many actions or precepts or hold many events, but the connection between them at heart, as one man and one heart, this is what they say that has to be kept. But because Israel are also next to the nations of the world, and also because Israel constantly get the burdening of the heart that comes from the ego that also pulls them to different kinds of idolatry, like with the idols, like with the different kinds of fetish. And so what follows is that also the nation of Israel throughout its history developed different such, as if things, means, that they look at as something holy, something special, that has to be kissed, bowed to, something. Meaning there's a kind of a mixture here between the root of the true Judaism, which is only the force of bestowal and only the force of connection and love of others, and different other signs that will join along the way, that are as a root and branch, let's call it that way, that in our corporeal world there are also signs that are more related to the force of bestowal than to the force of reception, even though that these forces have no expression in the corporeal world, but still mankind has this kind of an inclination toward that. And so we see that throughout history, Judaism, starting with the destruction of the first temple, and then the second temple, and then throughout the exile, then Judaism also took upon itself many different signs that are actually associated only to spiritual actions. They have nothing to do with our body or this world, but they saw that this way they can keep themselves in some kind of a corporeal framework. And this is where the different signs that we have in this world come from. My teacher, the Rabash, used to call it customs. That this is how we have to keep them. And why, until when? That until a person nonetheless reaches from his broken egoistic form, where he doesn't know where, why, how, that we fell into the ego as a result of our entire very difficult history with all the wars and crusades, starting with Pharaoh and actually to this day. So what follows is that we also need some kind of an external strengthening, signs, what we call practical actions, that also keep a person in that. So we keep these actions, and it holds mankind. I mean, not mankind, but the Jewish people, until they repent, until they reach a state where we can already understand that the main thing is, and also as the Ibn Ezra writes and other authors, that the main thing is the work in the heart, and that we have to keep all the mitzvot, the precepts of the Torah, in our heart. And what we do with our hands, legs, or orally, it's all in all in order for us, in order for it to advance us toward the work in the heart. But actually, what the Creator wants is the hearts. So you talked about two directions here. The one is that there is the point in the heart, and there is the Jew, who's a person that has two forces that act in him, both the natural force of reception and also a unique force, which is force of love, bestowal, love of others. This is actually what defines a Jew. And next to him, there are the nations of the world. So in the nations of the world, there is only the egoistic negative force, and in a Jew, there is the negative egoistic force, and next to it, also the positive altruistic force. So this is the first phenomenon you explained about, and the other phenomenon is that over time Jews started performing, keeping different external characteristics that maybe separated them from the rest of the people in the world and defined them as Jews externally wise. Well, for over 2,000 years now, we, as a nation, as a people, are disconnected from our spiritual perception. It's called being in exile. Exile isn't that we geographically left the land of Israel and now we're coming back to it. But it's a matter of an inner exile, that we're not in that quality of love and bestowal and connection between us. When we fell from this level, we ceased to exist as the people of Israel. So the topic of our show are the different incarnations of anti-Semitism throughout history. What changed about anti-Semitism over time? Every time there was as if a different reason for anti-Semitism. First of all, anti-Semitism comes as a result of every person feeling that in Jews, there is a certain quality that does not exist in others. And this quality is that there is a certain inclination toward connection in Jews. But in our world, it's not that conspicuous that it's an inclination toward connection. But nonetheless, It is a quality that allows them to permeate things more deeply, understand people more deeply, connect more deeply, because they have this inclination outwards. What is this inclination? Is it just a potential, or it is an inclination toward a good potential connection with others and a bad potential connection with others, meaning he feels the others, smells them, so to speak, much more than someone who is not Jewish. Due to that preparation that he has in order to connect with others in a good way. And he can also use it in a bad way, as if, not really, but to some extent. Meaning not in order to harm others, but in order to benefit off others for sure. This is what we see in business, finance, and so on. What changed? What's the difference between religious anti-Semitism, social anti-Semitism, where the Jew was? It's all according to the development. The more developed the ego is, the more it evolves in mankind from generation to generation. 2,000-3,000 years ago, we saw how primitive people were, how primitive nations were, and how much they have advanced. To this day, they cannot grasp that the upper force is a force. It's not a man or a woman or the different images of this world that could walk around, that there's nothing holy about flesh and blood, that there's no holiness in a stone or in a tree, that holiness can only be in the force of connection as opposed to the force of separation. And these are the only two forces that exist in nature, that's it. Meaning mankind cannot grasp these spiritual foundations that are abstract of matter, of material actions, physical actions, and therefore it's a problem that they cannot perceive, grasp what true Judaism is due to their natural inability, the lack of the positive force as opposed to the negative force. For this, you need two forces. Like in the wisdom of Kabbalah, you need two forces. You need the heart, which is the egoistic force, and the point in the heart, which is the foundation for the altruistic force. And it doesn't exist in everyone. And also, it doesn't matter whether you were born a Jew or you weren't born a Jew. It's not that important, because eventually, the point in the heart, the positive force, it awakens, it has to awaken, you can awaken it in every person. Simply in Jews, it has awoken as a result of Babylon, before others. Yeah, before others. This is what it's all about. And in the future, eventually everyone has the potential. As it says, all shall know me from small to great. So, going back to the different forms of anti-Semitism, the essence of anti-Semitism, whether it's of one or another kind, is it different in its different types or sorts? The essence of anti-Semitism differs both in types and also in degrees, because every nation has an anti-Semitism of their own towards Jews, according to the 70 nations of the world that exist, the 70 forms of ego that exist in mankind. So each of them has a bit of a different form towards Jews. And the more the nations of the world develop, the more the ego in them develops, that this is what brings them to technological development, cultural, educational, and so on. Along with it, also their attitude towards Jews develops. They better understand, feel, grasp that Jews are something else, something different, more successful. And then, as a result, of course they have a bigger and stronger demand toward the people of Israel from generation to generation. Let's take an anti-Semite from the Middle Ages and a contemporary anti-Semite. Is there a difference between what the two feel? Of course, a person from the Middle Ages felt much more deeply that everything that happens to him and his dependence on Jews versus today. Today we have medicine, chemistry, technology, different kinds of things by which we can use nature to our benefit. We understand the human systems, especially financial systems, and therefore those things that Jews were especially engaged in, both being next to the rulers, especially in the East, next to every king or ruler. And the Arab countries, for example, there was a Jew, Jews that were doctors, Jews that were engaged in the wisdom of the stars, that recommended what to do with the people. So today, the nations of the world already have enough knowledge, power, intellect that allows them to be engaged in that too, so that not only Jews will be engaged in it. So can we see this as a point of hope that over time anti-Semitism is decreasing because the differences are dissipating? No. Anti-Semitism will not decrease as a result, but to the contrary. It will go and grow and will become more unique. Will it take on a new evolutional form? Yes. Of what kind? That Jews are hated because there is some kind of a spiritual force in them that we don't have. And it's not that they're more successful at science or medicine or the different things of this world. But the thing is that the more successful the nations of the world become in developing different kinds of wisdom, the more they feel that there is a certain uniqueness about the people of Israel, and that this uniqueness is more hidden, exalted, and spiritual. And therefore, anti-Semitism will grow and will become more precise, scrutinized, sharp, and subtle. And all in all, it will become more threatening. So a new form of anti-Semitism will evolve? Yes. And will it be cruder or more subtle? I don't know what you mean by cruder or more subtle, but it'll become ever more evident to a non-Jew that there is something about Jews that can't exist in him and that he wants it. Yeah, still, it makes him curious. He understands that due to it, Jews are more successful, that there is a more chosen. Our time's almost up. I have to go to the final question. Up until now, we talked about the evolution of anti-Semitism, and you said that it will become more precise and more threatening. The way you see it, the way the wisdom of Kabbalah sees it, what can uproot anti-Semitism? That the nation of Israel will start functioning the way they're supposed to, meaning that they'll start connecting, and by that will set an example for the entire world of how to connect. And when you say to connect, what do you mean? To be connected as one man and one heart, like it says in the Torah. This picture where they're connected as one man, it's only for Jews or all people? For all people. But it has to start with the Jews, because only the Jews have the inclination towards it, the ability to do it, and it's their obligation. And this is the unique Jewish spiritual ability that you said that people feel that's missing in the world? They don't feel that this is what's missing, but they feel that the Jews have something that the world needs, that the world's lacking. So even if they get along without us in business, medicine, everything else there is in the world, still, it'll be even more lacking. Because then, they'll understand even better that because they lack this inclination toward connection, the ability to connect, they feel that this is what the world's lacking and that this is why the world's suffering, meaning that eventually Jews are causing suffering in the world. So they can also eradicate suffering from the world. Yes, by connecting and becoming light onto the nations. Dr. Lightman, thank you very much. I see that we still have a lot to talk about. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you, Yael. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.